This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Monday, April 29th, 2024. Secretary of State Antony Blinken calls a proposal for an Israel-Hamas ceasefire and hostage release extraordinarily generous and urges Hamas to accept it. State Department confirms five Israeli Defense Force military units were found in violation of a U.S. law called the Leahy Law, prohibiting U.S. aid to foreign security force units where there's credible information that the unit has committed gross violation of human rights. But they say the violations happened before the start of the current war, and four of the five IDF units have taken steps to remediate the violations. Pro-Palestinian protesters at Columbia University defy a deadline to leave their encampment or face suspension. NATO Secretary General Jan Stoltenberg makes an unannounced trip to Ukraine, criticizing the U.S. and European countries for failing to deliver promised weapons, although he says he expects that will change soon. Vice President Kamala Harris goes to Atlanta talking about the economy. The Poor People's Campaign co-chair, Reverend William Barber, discusses a march on Washington and to the polls scheduled for June, designed to mobilize poor and low-wage workers, whom he says are the largest potential swing vote bloc in the country. There's a special election on Tuesday to fill a seat in the U.S. Congress in Western New York. We'll hear from the two major party candidates about the economy and federal spending. And the last surviving Medal of Honor recipient from the Korean War lies in honor in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda. From the Times of Israel, United States Secretary of State Antony Blinken urged Hamas on Monday to swiftly accept Israel's latest and, in his words, extraordinarily generous proposal for a Gaza truce to secure release of hostages amid a diplomatic drive to halt the Israel-Hamas war. Hamas negotiators were expected to meet Qatari and Egyptian mediators in Cairo on Monday to deliver a response to the phased truce proposal Israel presented over the weekend ahead of a threatened Israeli assault on the southern border city of Rafah. A senior Hamas official said Sunday the Palestinian terror group had no major issues with the most recent truce plan. That was from the Times of Israel. Secretary Blinken spoke in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, his first stop on his latest Middle East visit. After meeting with Saudi officials, he was interviewed by the World Economic Forum president, Borga Brende.
During the two last days, it's been said from many speakers that there will never be a two-state solution without U.S. Taking leadership. But we also know that Egypt now presented a ceasefire and release of hostages deal to Israel. We learned that it's no with Hamas, and they will have to decide maybe what you think are the prospects. I guess if Hamas then doesn't accept this, I think Netanyahu has said that then he will go full-fledged into Rafah. So your visit, I guess, to Israel tomorrow will be very important, because I think there is a big fear in the region that for a further escalation.
Well, I think there's a lot to be said about this, of course, but to try to put it in a nutshell, a few things are important. One, we strongly support Israel in its effort to ensure that what happened on October 7th never happens again. But at the same time, we are determined to do everything we can to bring an end to the terrible human suffering that we're seeing every single day in Gaza among children, women, men who've been caught in a terrible crossfire of Hamas's making. And so maximizing protection of civilians, maximizing the support that gets to them, this is very much our focus. Now, the quickest way to bring this to an end is to get to a ceasefire and the release of hostages. And as you said, there's been an extraordinary effort that's been made, and I really want to thank profoundly our friends from Qatar and Egypt who've been playing an instrumental role in trying to get this ceasefire and release of hostages. A major effort that's been made over the last couple of months to get to that ceasefire, to get the hostages out. And right now, as you said, Hamas has before it a proposal that is extraordinarily, extraordinarily generous on the part of Israel. And in this moment, the only thing standing between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas. They have to decide, and they have to decide quickly. So we're looking to that, and I'm hopeful that they will make the right decision, and we can have a fundamental change in the dynamic.
But let's say that Hamas turns it down. Mm. You will still recommend Prime Minister Netanyahu tomorrow not to go ahead with that attack on Rafah?
We've said clearly and for some time now on Rafah that in the absence of a plan to ensure that civilians will not be harmed, we can't support a major military operation in Rafah. And we have not yet seen a plan that gives us confidence that civilians can be effectively protected.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken interviewed by the World Economic Forum President Borga Brende in Saudi Arabia. Former President Donald Trump, the likely Republican presidential nominee this year, wrote on his social media platform that Israel and Hamas are unable to negotiate a deal to release hostages because, quote, there are far fewer hostages than currently being thought. And another quote, Hamas is incapable of holding Jewish people for a long period of time without killing them. Story from CNN, the U.S. State Department has determined that five Israeli security units committed gross violations of human rights prior to the outbreak of the war with Hamas in Gaza, but is still deciding whether to restrict military assistance to one of the units under U.S. law. That's reportedly to be the ultra-Orthodox Neza Yehuda Battalion. Under the Leahy law, the U.S. cannot provide assistance to foreign security units that are credibly implicated in human rights abuses, but there is an exception permitting resumption of assistance to a unit if the Secretary of State determines and reports to Congress that the government of the country is taking effective steps to bring the responsible members of the security forces unit to justice. That was from CNN. Here's the State Department Deputy Spokesman Vedant Patel at his news conference.
After a careful process, we found five Israeli units responsible for individual incidents of gross violations of human rights. All of these were incidents much before October 7th, and none took place in Gaza. Four of these units have effectively remediated these violations, which is what we expect partners to do. It is consistent with what we expect all countries whom with we have a security relationship with. For a remaining unit, we continue to be in consultations and engagements with the government of Israel. They have submitted additional information as it pertains to that unit, and we're continuing to have those conversations consistent with the memorandum of understanding that we have with the government of Israel that was entered into in 2021. When conclusions are made under actions that fall under the auspices of the Foreign Assistance Act, we are required to consult with officials from the government of Israel, and that is ongoing. We are engaging with them in a process, and we will make an ultimate decision when it comes to that that unit when that process is complete. I would also just want to note that the remediation standard is consistent, and it is the same for all countries. And what we ask of of host governments in that situation is effective steps being taken consistent within their processes and systems to bring respective parties to justice. So as it relates to the process here, that's all the update that I have for now, but we're going to continue to engage with the government on that, and we will have more to share, I'm sure, at some point in the future.
U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel at his news conference today. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu posted a statement on X on Saturday. In recent weeks, he writes, I have been working against the imposition of sanctions on Israeli citizens, including in my conversations with senior American government officials. At a time when our soldiers are fighting the monsters of terror, the intention to impose a sanction on a unit in the IDF is the height of absurdity and a moral low. Story from AP. Colleges around the U.S. implored pro-Palestinian student protesters to clear out tent encampments with rising levels of urgency Monday, including an ultimatum from Columbia University for students to sign a form and leave the encampment by the afternoon or face suspension. Columbia activists defied the 2 p.m. deadline with chants, clapping, and drumming from the encampment of more than 300 people. No officials appeared to enter the encampment, with at least 120 tents staying up as the deadline passed. A notice sent Monday by the Ivy League University in Manhattan to protesters in the encampment said if they left by the deadline and signed a form committing to abide by university policies through June 2025 or an earlier graduation, they could finish the semester in good standing. If not, the letter said, they will be suspended pending further investigation. That was from Associated Press. The account on X, Columbia Students for Justice in Palestine, posted hundreds of Columbia University students are gathering for an emergency rally to protect the Gaza Solidarity encampment. We will continue until our demands are met. We will not be intimidated. And they included this video. And the chant is disclosed, divest, we will not stop, we will not rest. A question about this at the White House briefing to the press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre.
Following up on what you said earlier about the protests at Columbia, earlier you talked about how you didn't want to comment on what school administrators might do, but the protesters themselves have now defied a 2 p.m. deadline. Should they leave?
The protesters themselves have?
Yes, there was a deadline for them to leave by 2 p.m. and they have not done so. What does the White House think?
You mean that Columbia has said there is a 2 p.m. deadline for them? Okay. I'm just not going to comment on leadership at colleges and universities, their decisions. That's for them to decide. We've been very clear. Americans have the right to peacefully protest, and we're going to continue to call out any type of hateful rhetoric, any type of potential hateful violence here. It has no place in America. Anti-Semitism, we're going to call out. It is abhorrent, and that is hate speech. We're just going to be consistent. When it comes to those types of decisions on campuses, that is something for college, universities, leadership to decide on.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre in the White House briefing room with reporters. Story from the Texas Tribune. Arrests resumed Monday at the University of Texas at Austin amid ongoing demonstrations in support of Palestinians. Dozens of protesters gathered on campus where there was a sizable police presence, including officers from the Texas Department of Public Safety and the University of Texas Police Department. The Tribune observed a student being dragged away by a law enforcement officer while observers recorded videos. That was reporting from the Texas Tribune. Here is one of the videos posted from the scene.
Hands off our students! 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 Hands off our students!
In Washington, D.C., on the House floor, Congresswoman Marionette Miller-Meeks, Republican of Iowa, talked about the protests.
I rise today to condemn the anti-Semitic and anti-Jewish pro-Hamas demonstrations who, amidst Passover, are wreaking havoc on campuses around the country and threatening violence against local Jewish communities and students. Such violence is unacceptable anywhere, but to witness this at our universities is truly painful. Places of education are supposed to be of discourse and of learning and rising above. And all those who choose to attend deserve peace and respect. My heart goes out to all of the Jewish students who no longer feel safe at American universities. They deserve better than this. Mr. Speaker, the purveyors of anti-Semitism must be stopped. I ask my colleagues to join me in condemning these anti-Semitic protesters and continue the push to combat anti-Semitism and stand with our Jewish friends and neighbors.
Congresswoman Marionette Miller Meeks, Republican from Iowa, speaking on the House floor. A story from The Hill. A group of House Democrats is urging Columbia University's Board of Trustees to end the ongoing protest encampment on the campus or step down from their positions. Josh Gottheimer, Democrat from New Jersey, and Dan Goldman, Democrat from New York, led the group of 21 colleagues in sending a letter to the board demanding school officials put an end to the encampment, which has garnered national attention for more than a week. We, the undersigned, write to express our disappointment that despite promises to do so, Columbia University has not disbanded the unauthorized and impermissible encampment of anti-Israel, anti-Jewish activists on campus, the Democratic lawmakers wrote that from The Hill. The U.S. House may consider legislation regarding this, and we spoke about it with Politico's Congress reporter Catherine Tully McManus.
Speaker Johnson goes to Columbia University last week. We heard his words there saying he was going to speak to the president about bringing in the National Guard to quell some of these protests. Are we going to see some sort of legislative action that gets Congress more involved here when it comes to campus student protests, free speech versus hate speech, all these issues that have been swirling around these protests?
Yes, I think that first, the easiest thing that Congress can do are resolutions. You know, in
this is a sense of the House.
Sense of the House, things in support of Israel, in opposition to anti-Semitism. And I do expect to see, you know, Republicans leading the charge to condemn anti-Semitic speech on college campuses. And that is something that could come as soon as this week, action on that. I think that substantive game-changing legislation is going to be very hard to come by in the coming weeks and months. And on this topic, especially where even, you know, there's divisions within the Jewish community, there's divisions politically, but among Democrats. And I think that will be more challenging.
Catherine Tully McManus, a Congress reporter with Politico on C-SPAN's morning program, Washington Journal. Story from The Guardian, the Democratic U.S. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries has released a letter to Republican Speaker Mike Johnson requesting consideration of a bipartisan bill to counter anti-Semitism. The chamber is expected this week to consider the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, a different bill that would require the Education Department to adopt the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism, which has been criticized for equating criticism of Israel with prejudice against Jews. In his letter, Jeffries asked Johnson to allow a vote on the bipartisan Countering Anti-Semitism Act, which would create a federal coordinator to fight anti-Jewish sentiment. That was from The Guardian. This is Washington Today. Story from Reuters, NATO boss Jens Stoltenberg told Ukrainians on Monday that his alliance's members had failed to live up to their promises of military aid in recent months, but said the flow of arms and ammunition would now increase. In an unannounced visit to Ukraine, the Secretary General of the Transatlantic Military Alliance held talks with President Volodymyr Zelensky and was due to address Ukraine's parliament. His visit, the third since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, comes at a difficult time on the battlefield for Ukraine. After a failed Ukrainian counteroffensive last year, Russian forces have gained the initiative, at least in part due to a dearth of arms and ammunition from Kyiv's Western partners. That was reporting from Reuters. Here's part of the news conference held in Kyiv and the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg.
NATO allies have not delivered what they promised. The United States spent months not agreeing a package for Ukraine, and European allies have not delivered the amount of ammunition they promised. And this had had serious consequences on the battlefield. The lack of ammunition has enabled the Russians to push forward along the front line. Lack of air defense has made it possible for more Russian missiles to hit their targets. And the lack of deep strike capabilities has made it possible for the Russians to concentrate more forces. And we see the consequences of that now. Therefore, it is extremely important that over the last couple of weeks, we have seen some very important changes. The big U.S. announcement of $61 billion really is significant. The United Kingdom has announced its biggest ever package, including air defenses and millions of rounds of ammunition. And then you have many other allies stepping up with different types of announcements. So now our responsibility is to ensure that these announcements are turned into real deliveries, physical deliveries of weapons and ammunition as soon as possible. And this logistic work, the practical implementation of delivery of ammunition and weapons to Ukraine is shared by General Cavoli, the U.S. top commander in Europe, is responsible for that effort. I'm in regular contact with him, and he is very much aware of the urgency. So they do whatever they can to make sure that announcements are turned into deliveries as quickly as possible, because time matters, every day matters.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg at a joint news conference in Kyiv with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. And according to Associated Press, President Zelensky said new Western supplies have started arriving, but slowly this process must be speeded up, he said at that news conference. The U.S. ambassador to NATO, Julian Smith, spoke today at an Atlantic Council discussion looking ahead to the NATO summit to be held in Washington, D.C., July 9th through 11th. She said that Ukraine will eventually join NATO, but not right now.
NATO allies have been crystal clear. We've been clear since 2008 that Ukraine will become a member of the alliance. We reaffirmed that last year at the Vilnius summit when we said that Ukraine's future place is in NATO, but we were not prepared last summer to extend a proper invitation to Ukraine for full-fledged membership, and I am not expecting the alliance to do that this summer. What I am expecting allies to do is to construct a bridge to membership by offering Ukraine a deliverable that will enable them to become even closer to this alliance. Last summer, we created something called the NATO-Ukraine Council, which just met a couple of weeks ago with President Zelensky, which enables Ukraine to come to the NATO table, sit at the table as an equal, and discuss whatever is on their mind. In this moment, we were able to talk to President Zelensky about his very real defense requirements, what they need right now in real time for success on the battlefield. But this NATO-Ukraine Council is something that we already created last summer, and you're going to see more news on what the allies are prepared to unveil this summer at the summit. I can't go into a lot of detail because allies are in the process of debating that right now, but what I will say is we are looking at a way to institutionalize here at NATO some of the bilateral support that's been provided to Ukraine over the last 2 years.
U.S. Ambassador to NATO Julian Smith joining virtually an Atlantic Council program in Washington, D.C., talking about the upcoming NATO summit in July. The Ukrainian ambassador to the U.S., Oksana Markova, appeared in person and said it is okay that Ukraine will not be formally invited to join NATO this time around, as long as there's an understanding that Ukraine eventually will become NATO's 33rd member.
It's very important to say that this policies of buffer zones, gray zones, appeasing Russia by having Ukraine between NATO and Russia do not really work. It's actually quite opposite. NATO was never a threat to Russia. Russia was always a threat to all of us. Russia attacked Moldova in the beginning of 90s, Georgia in 2008, Ukraine in 2014. During all these years, Ukraine and Georgia and other countries were neutral. That didn't stop Russia from attacking them. It's actually the other way around. If you are not a member of a civilized family of countries with the same values, that's when Russia thinks you are weak and they attack you. So I think we have to be very clear. Are we, after 16 years of discussions, on the same page or not with regard to the main thing? Should Ukraine be a member of NATO? And as the Ukrainian ambassador, of course, I would argue, but not only as Ukrainian ambassador, that Ukraine has a lot to add to NATO. With the most capable and battle-tested army, with the army that is not only using the NATO equipment, because we pretty much use now all the NATO-produced equipment, but understand together with the former Soviet and Russian equipment. And we have even with the US this Franken-SEM program where we actually are using some of them together to the best of the use. And if you really want to deter aggressive Russia, which this is what it is, then you can only do it on the eastern flank. Now, which is the true eastern flank of NATO? This is the eastern flank of Ukraine. Because you cannot deter Russia from behind a very, very large territory unless, of course, you are prepared for Ukraine to lose this war, which we as Ukrainians are not prepared. It's an existential war for us. So we will fight until we win. And if we win together and Ukraine becomes member of NATO, that will make not only Ukraine, but NATO and all transatlantic family more secure. Mm-hmm. So this is, I think, what we have to discuss. And then if we are all on the same page on this, then how we get there, the very specific, concrete plan on how to be more prepared and ready for NATO, whether it's from interoperability perspective, which, by the way, we are doing through not only our EOP status, but our annual plans, which all of our annual plans with NATO Ukraine executed successfully, or through the NATO-Ukraine Council, which was created in Vilnius. I mean, there are venues to do that. Or if there are legal challenges to discuss, you know, how do you progress, why the country is an active war, then we should put together lawyers to discuss it. But that's all how. It's not what.
Ukrainian Ambassador to the U.S., Oksana Makarova, at the Atlantic Council in Washington. A ceremony in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda where the ashes of Colonel Ralph Puckett Jr., the last surviving Medal of Honor recipient from the Korean War, when he passed away at age 97 on April 8th, lying in honor. WRBL-TV in Columbus, Georgia, where Colonel Puckett lived, reports that in November 1950, he was commanding the 8th Army Rangers in Korea when the unit captured Hill 205 behind enemy lines. They lost the hill on the 6th Chinese counterattack. Puckett was seriously injured in the battle and ordered his men to retreat and abandon him. They refused the order and drug Puckett to safety at the bottom of the hill. Puckett became an iconic figure in the U.S. Army Ranger community. The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, spoke at today's ceremony.
Along the front line near the Chinese border, U.S. forces in Ralph Puckett's sector were outnumbered 3-2. But on the hill 205, where his small company would take a stand more than a mile from the nearest reinforcements, they were outnumbered 10-1. It's difficult to imagine a starker embodiment of the motto, Rangers lead the way. Perhaps on November 25th, 1950, Ralph Puckett repeated the simple prayer he offered when he took command. Don't let me get a bunch of good guys killed. Perhaps he asked for the strength, the courage, and the resolve to discharge his duty and lead his men with honor. With the benefit of hindsight, all of us here today know that prayer was granted. Ralph Puckett wore our nation's highest military decoration, and in the hearts of generations of soldiers to come, the courage and self-sacrifice that earned that honor will be this great man's eternal legacy. The man who volunteered for command, who repeatedly risked his own life to defend his position, rally his men, and order them to safety without him, who, in the words of the prophet Isaiah, said, "Here am I, send me." Today, the Senate joins Ralph's wife, Jeannie, their daughter, Martha, their son, Thomas, and the entire Puckett family in remembrance of an extraordinary American. It is an honor to welcome Colonel Ralph Puckett Jr. to the Capitol.
The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, at today's ceremony in the rotunda. The House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, also made some remarks. More from the WRBL-TV article in Columbus, Georgia. There is a subtle difference between lying in state and lying in honor. Lying in state is reserved for political leaders, such as presidents. Lying in honor is a recognition given to citizens who did extraordinary things. And fittingly, the last person to lie in honor in the Capitol was Herschel W. Woody Williams, who was the last live WW2 Medal of Honor recipient. He was recognized in July 2022, and less than 50 people have been afforded the honor of lying in honor in the Capitol. That from that article, WRBL-TV. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi there. I'm Jonathan from C-SPAN, along with my colleague, Ben. Since C-SPAN's founding 45 years ago, the media world has changed. Remember when there were just a few TV channels? Now we've got streaming, social media, apps, and more.
Through all of this, C-SPAN has stayed true to its mission of giving you unfiltered access to government wherever you get your news. As we navigate this challenging media environment with fewer people subscribing to traditional cable packages, our funding has been impacted.
That's why we're asking for your help to keep going strong for another 45 years. Please donate today at cspan.org/donate. Your contribution, large or small, helps ensure at least another 45 years of witnessing democracy in action.
Keep C-SPAN thriving in today's ever-changing media landscape. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your gift today. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now mobile app and wherever you find your podcasts. Vice President Kamala Harris, writes Fox 5 Atlanta, will be back in Atlanta on Monday, kicking off the Biden administration's Economic Opportunity Tour. The vice president's tour will kick off with a moderated conversation highlighting the economic opportunities created by the Biden-Harris administration. The vice president will then travel to Detroit the following week and then head to other states across the country. Vice President Harris is playing a large role in the efforts to drum up support among African-American and young voters for the Democratic Party's reelection campaign. With Georgia being considered a swing state, it's no surprise why Harris is making her 12th trip to the Peach State since she became vice president. That was from Fox 5 Atlanta. Here's part of today's conversation.
During the late 50s and 60s, there was this whole policy push, national policy push, that was called urban renewal. But what it ended up doing was, and it was supposed to be about making life easier for people that live in the areas where it happened. But essentially, it was about a policy that was directed in making it, many people will say, easier for folks who had wealth and means to move to the suburbs and still have access to downtown. I'm oversimplifying it, but that's essentially it. And you see across the country, I'm going to be in Detroit on this tour, I'm going to be in Milwaukee. As you all know, I'm from California, from the Bay Area. We saw it there, where these freeways were built, and it basically to cut through communities, which bifurcated the community so that folks couldn't have easy access to, let's say, the small businesses from where they lived. And it ended up decimating these communities for years. So what we have been doing through our infrastructure bill is putting resources into basically reconnecting communities. So here in Atlanta, for example, freeway 75 and 85, what we are doing is dealing with the fact that I guess there was a division from Sweet Auburn from downtown, and what we need to do to reconnect by creating basically pathways that include over that pathway, creating parks, but literally the infrastructure and recreating that infrastructure so we can reconnect communities. So here in Atlanta, there is going to be $158 million out of our infrastructure bill that will do that work, and it's going to create, we estimate, about 13,000 jobs. And also focus on affordable housing, which was one of the big issues that we're facing as a country.
Vice President Kamala Harris. A special election is being held on Tuesday to fill a vacancy in Western New York's 26th congressional district. It is vacant because Democrat Brian Higgins resigned to take another job. Last week, the Democratic nominee for this seat, State Senator Tim Kennedy, debated the Republican nominee, West Seneca Town Supervisor Gary Dixon, on WIVB-TV in Buffalo. One of the questions they answered was about the economy and federal spending.
Gentlemen, we now move on to the economy. Mr. Kennedy, we'll start with you on this question. The U.S. economy is improving with months of record job creation and a strong stock market, but inflation continues to soar, and interest rates and the cost of living remain exorbitant. What initiatives do you support to help ease the burden on taxpayers while also controlling spending in Washington?
Well, I come from a working-class family in South Buffalo, New York. We are a community of middle-class working families, and being a part of a family that has had to work several jobs just to put food on the table, keep the lights on. My mother's a nurse, worked three jobs. My father worked odd jobs, ran a delicatessen, Kennedy's Delicatessen in South Buffalo, all the penny candy free for the kids when they were coming up so everybody knows them, but went on to take a civil service test. But in past that, it rose to the highest levels of city government as a city assessor. You know, we're a middle-class family. I've seen the struggles of middle-class families. We need to make sure there are jobs and opportunities for individuals in our community, the next generation. We need to provide for those that want to go to work here to be able to do so, to provide for their families and live the American dream right here in the Buffalo Niagara region.
All right, Mr. Dixon, the same question to you. What initiatives do you support to help ease the burden on taxpayers while also controlling spending in Washington?
Well, I mean, we see an example of the career politician's answer, which is not an answer. You asked how to control inflation. Spending is the number one cause of inflation in this country. It's overspending and too much debt on the part of the federal government, and it's too much debt on the part of the state government. The state government, under my opponent's leadership, has seen record increases. It's called by independent monitors unsustainable costs into the future. And sending someone who can't control a state budget to the national level is, to me, nonsensical. Me, for myself, when I was elected to go into West Seneca, I promised that we would control spending and we would not increase taxes, and we did not increase taxes for 4 years.
Mr. Kennedy, do you have a response to that?
Yeah, look, everybody agrees that inflation is an issue. But you know what? Inflation has actually cooled in the last couple of years, and it's beginning to right the ship. What we need to do, regardless of what inflation is across this country, is make sure we're creating jobs and opportunities for Western New Yorkers. I grew up in this community. Unlike my opponent, who just came into our community, my family goes back here generations. The bottom line is, I was here during the depression of our community, where we were seeing jobs and opportunities flee along with my generation. Now we see them coming back. We need to make sure that we create jobs for the future.
The major party candidates in the special election for the U.S. House seat in New York's 26th congressional district, Republican Gary Dixon and Democrat Tim Kennedy, debating on April 24th. The election is tomorrow, April 30th. It's one of six vacancies in the U.S. House. There are currently 217 Republicans and 212 Democrats. Reverend William Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, wrote on X today, "Major announcement at the National Press Club, Poor People's Campaign to hold mass assembly and moral march on Washington June 29th to launch unprecedented outreach to the largest swing vote in the 2024 election, poor and low-wage, inactive eligible voters." Reverend Barber led this news conference. He said that there are over 135 million poor and low-wage people in the country, every race, creed, and religion, every region of the country, and the group's goal is to touch 15 million of them.
Poor and low-wage voters are saying in this season that we, our votes are demands and not merely support for candidates. And what we're doing is mobilizing those votes and saying to candidates, if you want these votes, then talk to poor and low-wage folk. The number one reason poor and low-wage folk do not vote, according to the study, is Waking the Sleeping Giant, is nobody talks to them. We have debate after debate for Senate, for president, and the issues that affect poor and low-wage persons do not come up. We had in 2020 a bill come up to pass a living wage of $15 an hour in the union, which would have lifted 52 million poor and low-wage Americans out of poverty and low wage. 43% of African Americans alone. Most of the persons would have been white and women. And 8 Democrats and 49 Republicans said no to 52 million Americans. That 70% of Americans want a raise in the living wage because we haven't raised the minimum wage since 2009. Poor and low-wage folk and moral and religious leaders are saying no more. We must mobilize this power. And we want the media to be clear that when we talk about poverty, we're talking about in all of its areas, race, gender, geography. A third of all poor people live in the South. A third of all poor white people live in the South. Nearly 60% of black people are poor and low wage, but the majority of people who are poor and low wage are white, over 40 million more than the number of black folk in raw numbers. The largest demographic of poverty is among women, predominantly white women. And our children now are 51% of all children are poor and low wage. These are serious matters, and we have serious power. So this is an offensive move. We're calling on people to come by the thousands, by the thousands, to join with us. This is a time for a mass mobilization of consciousness, to call people to vote. We don't just need a political vote this year. We need a movement vote that's not based on party, but based on principle, based on where people stand on critical issues. So we're calling on folks. This is a nonviolent We are the resurrection, not an insurrection. That's why we're coming. And we're saying the last picture of what of D.C. ought not be people tearing the Capitol up and trying to tear democracy down. We need a picture of folk trying to build a democracy up and lift up all people, regardless of who they are.
Reverend William Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, today at the National Press Club in Washington, announcing the Mass Poor People's and Low-Wage Workers' Assembly and Moral March on Washington and to the polls, and it's scheduled for June 29th. Wall Street today, the Dow up 146, NASDAQ up 55, S&P up 16. From the Washington Examiner, key Senate and House negotiators unveiled a long-awaited bill early Monday morning to reauthorize the Federal Aviation Administration for the next 5 years, a major must-pass item ahead of the May 10th deadline. The deal would boost funding intended to avert close-call collisions on runways, improve air traffic controller staffing, maintain the current pilot retirement age at 65, and grant 10 additional slots at Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport or 5 round-trip flights. Congress extended the authorization for the critical agency, allowing more time to complete the $105 billion bill, which the Senate is expected to vote on this week. That was from the Washington Examiner. From Politico, amid waves of backlash from both sides of the aisle, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem on Sunday defended her decision to shoot and kill her 14-month-old puppy named Cricket years ago. She wrote on Truth Social, "I can understand why some people are upset about a 20-year-old story of Cricket, one of the working dogs at our ranch, in my upcoming book, Not Going Back. The fact is," she writes, "South Dakota law states that dogs who attack and kill livestock can be put down. Given that Cricket had shown aggressive behavior toward people by biting them, I decided what I did." That was reporting by Politico. This came up at today's White House briefing with the press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre.
Finally, one more, Karine. As a dog lover himself, what does the president and the White House think about Kristi Noem's upcoming
book? Yeah, I saw that. It's very sad. It's very sad. It's a sad story. That's all I have for you. It's sad.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, the Democratic National Committee, put out a statement calling the excerpts from the book horrifying and disturbing. The full title of the book is No Going Back, The Truth on What's Wrong with Politics and How We Move America Forward. Release date is May 7th. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, Word for Word, and get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.